Good morning, panel members. I'm Scott Robinson, registration number 6633. I'm here to ask you to reverse the conviction of Vicente Mendez and remand it for a new trial on two separate grounds. I'd like to begin, unless I'm directed otherwise, with the initial issue that I raised in the brief. The issue is the adequacy or inadequacy of the first advisement provided by the trial judge. As this court knows from reading the briefs, there is a threshold issue which needs to be resolved. That threshold issue arises as a result of the Supreme Court decision in Blem in 1999. The issue is, can this court review the inadequacy claimed of the first advisement, or need this case be remanded for a P 35C post-conviction motion to flesh out an evidentiary record? In that regard, as I'm pretty sure every member of the division knows, the case of Wessel Moore is pending before the Colorado Supreme Court. It will be orally argued on Thursday of this week at 10 o'clock. While I do not plan to attend the oral argument, nevertheless, I think I need to bring to the division's attention. I don't know what your procedure should be in that regard. Do you wait and see what the Supreme Court says? That could be months. Or do you resolve this case in a manner that you think is appropriate and let the chips fall as they may? But the Moore case, as this court knows, was granted cert on two important issues. One, it's the second case since Gomez being the first, Moore being the second, to hold that when an issue is a matter of first impression, since it's the appellate judges who determine what the law is, it should be decided as a legal matter in this division first. If you decide that the curse advisement was inadequate for failure to advise Vicente Mendez that the complaining witness, BW, would then be able to testify, then it could be remanded for an evidentiary hearing along the lines of Gomez. What the standard is on remand, I think, is also of critical importance, but that's a decision that the court may not choose to reach. That is by far the most judicially economic way to take care of this issue, but it is somewhat in disregard of Blem. The advantage of making that legal determination now is that if the Hearst advisement is held to be adequate, there is no need for additional hearings before the trial judge. If it's held to be inadequate, then the issue of what happens next is something that is decided by the trial judge. And what I think is really significant about the Gomez and Moore decisions is that they involve a common sense approach to a situation which could in fact prove troublesome enough that our Supreme Court ruled in 1999 that we need a post-conviction hearing first. My view is we need to decide if the Curtis advisement was inadequate as a matter of law, as a matter of first impression, first.
So, Mr. Robinson, why wasn't the Curtis advisement in this case adequate?
There were two aspects of it. It was misleading, but more importantly, it failed to tell Vicente Mendez of the single most important salient consequence of taking a stand. As you know from reading the record and the brief, the complaining witness BW's testimony was barred by the trial judge for failure to endorse her by the prosecution. It would be clear to anyone, if they were a lawyer, that testimony by Mendez would open the door to rebuttal testimony on the part of BW.
And Mr. Mendez had a lawyer, right?
He did have a lawyer.
So why isn't that the lawyer's responsibility as opposed to the trial court?
Well, that's why we look back to Curtis, and that's why I started my discussion in the brief with Curtis, because what Curtis tells us is that it's significant, in fact, it's critical, that the trial judge make an adequate advisement. To be sure, in the later Mosey decision, which involved the reverse Curtis situation, the Supreme Court did note that defense counsel, in their view, was more likely to pressure a defendant not to testify than to testify, which I personally find curious, because when my clients in my trial practice ask me for my opinion about whether they should testify or not, I do a riddle with them. And the riddle is, what do you call a defendant who does not testify? And the answer? A conflict. So I strongly approve of clients testifying, but we don't know what Mr. Mendez was told. That's something that can be fleshed out on remand, assuming this court rules that the advisement was inadequate. The second aspect of the problem with first advisement was that in a rather confusing way, and I'll try to do this as best I can from memory, Mr. Mendez was told, you also have a right not to testify. You may absolutely remain absolutely silent. If you do not, the jury will be instructed on that right. That confuses what will happen, what the instruction to the jury will be. Surely the judge meant to say, if you remain silent and choose not to testify, the jury will be instructed on that right. But that's not what the judge said. And so,
counsel, why is Curtis even implicated here? It's not a situation where he gave up that right. In fact, he took full advantage of the right, and he did testify.
He did, and that's why we look at People versus Mosey. As the Supreme Court held in Mosey, decided, I think, 8 years after Lamb, that's the reverse side of the coin. And you still have to have an adequate Curtis advisement. The analysis changes, but as the Supreme Court observed in Mosey, you're really looking at the same decision, one way or the other.
But if I look at the instructions that Curtis indicates should be given, those instructions were given here. You want Curtis Plus. Isn't that what you're effectively arguing for?
What I want is the spirit of Curtis to be extended to include salient consequences of testifying that are inevitable in a specific case.
And Mr. Robinson, haven't we had a number of appellate decisions that have reached a contrary conclusion?
If the reference is to decisions like Coit and York, I would agree, but each case is different. We can't ask our trial judges to anticipate potential specific impeachment without giving them full access to the police reports and basically letting them do the lawyer's jobs. That's not realistic. But in this case, the single most salient consequence of Vicente Mendez taking the stand was that the otherwise barred testimony of PW would be resurrected and revived. And of course, that was by far the most significant piece of evidence against him.
Well, even assuming what you're saying is correct, how would the trial court have known, for even assuming the trial court could have anticipated that the victim would have testified, how would the trial court have known what she would have testified to?
Could not have. But certainly the idea would not be known to a lay person that a witness whose testimony had been barred because of a perceived procedural irregularity by the prosecution would suddenly come back into play if you took the stand. So it isn't, what doesn't matter is what BW said. What matters is that it was the single most salient consequence in this particular case of Mendez taking the stand. And I think if there's one thing our appellate courts have been sensitive to over the 3+ decades that I've been around as a lawyer, is that we recognize that different fact situations and different fact patterns may require some modification or alteration of rules that don't apply in every single case.
Hey, counsel, I could see your point if Mr. Mendez had opted to proceed pro se, where he wouldn't be charged with knowing the strategic calls, but this is exactly the kind of strategic decision that the counsel should consider and should consult with his or her client about. So why should we make the trial court intrude upon that relationship?
I don't see Curtis and any salient consequence of being an intrusion. I see it on the opposite side. I see it as a necessary recognition that people who are charged with crimes and facing trial may not always receive the best advice from their lawyers, and that we, as a judicial system, want to make sure that the accused knows all of their rights, and most importantly, as Curtis and Milton hold, the salient consequence of testimony. Without question, I'm asking this court to extend Curtis to include this specific fact situation. There's no doubt that it's not something that's covered by Curtis, nor by Mosey, nor by any other appellate decision yet handed down. And that, of course, is why I think it's something that should be decided by this court in this appeal, and not on remand on the 35C.
And how far would the trial court's duties then go? I mean, would the trial court then have to anticipate the whole case by the prosecution and warn the defendant about what could happen, or, you know, the various permutations of trial?
No. But in this case, the single most salient consequence, a consequence which any attorney who was sitting in that courtroom would have known was coming, any attorney, would have been the revival of BW's testimony. And as a consequence, I'm asking this court to extend Curtis to that extent.
Mr. Robinson, if I remember correctly, in People v. Blinn, the Supreme Court modified the holding in Curtis to require a 35C hearing so that the court could consider not only the trial court's advisement, but the whatever information the defense attorney provided to the defendant regarding the Curtis advisement. Am I correct in that regard?
Absolutely.
So if that's so, wouldn't that militate here in favor of saying that there should have been a 35C hearing, so the court, the trial court in the 35C proceeding could determine whether or not Mr. Mendez's attorney talked to him about the possibility of the victim testifying as a rebuttal witness?
Were it not for Gomez and Moore, I would be standing here without any support for asking you to decide it now. But we have Gomez, and at least temporarily, we have Moore. And I think this case involving a matter of first impression fits the parameters of the Gomez and Moore exception to the Blinn decision. And that's why, of course, I brought up the fact that Moore's being argued in 2 days. I would like to just mention one case on the second issue. As you know, it's my position that the trial judge erred in telling the jury that they could use their collective understanding of the meaning of critical terms and the elements of the offense in determining guilt or innocence. And as when I went through the cases over the weekend in preparation for tonight, for my oral argument today, I did come across Judge Todman's decision in Palavan that I did cite in the brief. It's a 10-year-old decision in the concept of a consent instruction. And I think that's really what the judge needed to do here. As the leading case of Leonardo versus People held, when jurors ask about a legal definition and show some misunderstanding about the legal definitions, the judge has an absolute duty to respond in some way other than look at the instructions you have, or even worse, use your collective understanding. What the judge did here at the behest of the prosecution was inject an element of subjectivity into the definition of legal terms that is absolutely inconsistent with fair trial.
But it wasn't just at the prosecution's behest. Defense counsel was asked to state a position and he had no objection.
He was passive. He was not active. And I think that's an important difference between invited error and plain error. As I acknowledged in my brief, this is a plain error argument, but it is not an invited error situation. And the case law on that I cited in my opening and reply briefs. To be sure, defense counsel did not object at the time. But had he not, this would have still been an unresponsive answer to the jury's question. And when they came back with juror question number 2, specifically asking for a definition of submission, at that point, it was absolutely incumbent upon the court, consistent with Leonardo and his progeny, to provide a definition of submission. And there were definitions out there, as I indicated in my brief. I have 40 seconds. I would like to maintain them if possible.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Robinson.
morning, may it please the court. My name is Michael McMaster, registration number 42368, and I'm here on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I'll be addressing both issues before the court. I'd like to first make 2 points regarding the defendant's Curtis advisement, and then 3 with respect to the jury question. Here, the defendant was adequately advised of his right to testify and his right to remain silent. But before we address the merits of the Curtis claim, again, the threshold issue, as counsel already pointed out, is that Blend is binding precedent in this case. Blend establishes a new procedure subsequent to Curtis. First, the defendant must file a post-conviction motion alleging an effective waiver. If the waiver contains the 5 Curtis elements, as it does here, then the record conclusively establishes a valid waiver.
Mr. McMaster, what about the Moore and Gomez cases? I assume that the Court of Appeals decisions in those cases didn't say, we're just going to ignore Blem, but rather distinguish Blem.
Your Honor, the language in Moore indicates that because the people didn't cite Blem, it was going to address the merits, so here we're citing it. Frankly, Your Honors, regardless how this court goes, it doesn't prejudice the people because the claim fails either way. However, I do think it's incumbent upon me to point out what I read as binding and mandatory authority in Blem.
Well, let me just follow up on that, if I might, Mr. McMaster. As I understand, Mr. Robinson's position is that he's arguing a legal issue which we can decide as a matter of law, and for that reason, it's not necessary to have a Rule 35C hearing. And if that were the case, then couldn't we say that notwithstanding the what otherwise might appear to be clear language in Blem, that the holding is, that this case is distinguishable?
Mm-hmm. Here, I think there are 2 responses. First, I don't think that this is a issue of first impression. If we look at the York decision and the Harris decision, both cases hold that a court need not advise a defendant of the collateral consequences of testifying or remaining silent. Second, in Blem, I think, I don't read anything in Blem that allows the court to simply ignore if it's first impression or not. And perhaps more importantly, we don't have a factual record that this court could use to craft what would be a new rule. The defendant is pretty clear that he is asking for a new rule, yet we don't have that factual record that would be necessary to create that new rule. As the court has already indicated, we don't know what the defendant believed, we don't know what his defense counsel told him or advised him before trial and during trial. All of that, I think, would be important and perhaps necessary to have if we were to create a new rule.
But we know what the trial court didn't say, so why isn't that a sufficient record for us to decide that trial court has or doesn't have a duty?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We know that the trial court did not warn Mr. Mendez that the victim could testify if he chose to take the stand. And maybe this trial court should have done that in this case. He had already excluded her testimony, so you know, a non-lawyer like the defendant could reasonably believe, okay, she's far from testifying. Now I get to, you know, say my version of what happened. Why shouldn't we impose that duty on the trial court when we know from the record that the trial court did not give that warning?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's similar answers to Judge Thomas's question. The first being, we already have appellate cases saying the court need not do that. But also, if this court wanted to make that new rule, it would seem strange to me to make that rule before knowing if that lack of advisement actually affected the defendant's decision to testify. And I think that highlights the post-conviction proceedings that were outlined in Blem. It provides, I think, good rationale for why we want this to be in post-conviction first, and then the defendant can appeal from there once we have that factual record. And it's probably worth mentioning that we allow trial courts to make factual rulings all the time, and they're certainly well equipped to do so. It's not something that's the exclusive job of the appellate court.
So are you recommending that we hold off on our decision on the Curtis issue then and reserve it as a 35C?
I think, like Mr. Robinson, I'm not quite sure what the best course of action would be. That certainly is probably a wise one.
Just out of curiosity, Mr. McMaster, let me ask you this question. If we were to hold that the proper remedy here is to file a 35C proceeding, and Mr. Mendez were to file a 35C motion, would he be allowed to litigate the merits of that in the district court, or would the people object to that on the ground that it was excessive because he's already raised it here on this appeal?
I think providing the court here doesn't address the merits, I think he's then permitted to file the 35C motion. And I think that's what happened in O'Hara and Gibson, the two case, are two of the cases which I cited in my brief, where this court simply declined to address the issue at all because of the binding authority in Boren. So, briefly, to talk about the jury questions, again, we do have a threshold issue, and I want to first point this court's attention to People versus Hoover, which held that active participation or express agreement in the preparation of a response to a jury question bars a defendant from claiming error. The defendant and I disagree on whether or not defense counsel actively participated. I certainly think he did, but even if he didn't, no one disputes that he expressly agreed to the responses given by the trial court. There's no distinction between meek or enthusiastic agreement, and we can't even tell which one is which based on the transcript. It's simply the plain language there. And then Hoover, I think, also is nice because in there, that the express agreement that this court found barred the defendant from raising that claim was very similar language. Like, I'm fine with either, or fine. Language like that was sufficient to bar the claim because it was express agreement in the answers prepared by the court in response to the jury question. So I think there, that is a sufficient result of this issue because the defendant is barred from raising the claim.
But let's move on to the merits of that issue. I do understand your position on the procedural aspect of that issue. But with regard to the merits in this collective understanding concept, the question didn't come from an individual juror, or even two or three of them. It came from the collective jury, right? Mm-hmm. So the collective jury was asking for help on that. So how does it provide them with guidance to say, use your collective understanding of what you understand the law to be when they collectively sent the questions up?
I don't think the court erred in providing that answer to use their collective understanding because it accurately states the law. Here, submission is not defined by statute or case law, and in Walden, this court said that juries are presumed to use the common meaning of a word that's not been defined by statute or case law. And so, with the court instructing them to use their collective understanding, that is an accurate statement of the law. They're supposed to use their collective understanding or the common meaning. Now, to be clear, I'm using those phrases interchangeably, and I don't think that there's a difference. They're functionally synonymous. To the extent there's a difference between common meaning and collective understanding, I don't think that difference rises to the level of plain error.
So how does that interplay with the Leonardo line of cases that says when they're looking for guidance on the elements that you should be providing them with such guidance if you can?
Sure. Well, Leonardo, I don't think it's as expansive as that, Your Honor. And it says that the court should respond when the jury, quote, affirmatively indicates it has a fundamental misunderstanding of the instruction. In Leonardo, the jury asks, is knowing the same as having suspicion of? And that question alone demonstrates what the court identified as a fundamental misunderstanding, because there is a significant difference between knowing and having a suspicion of. And that question alone, affirmatively indicates a fundamental misunderstanding. Here, the two questions asked by the jury do not affirmatively indicate a fundamental misunderstanding of the instruction. With the second question asking for a definition of submission, I think it's entirely plausible to think that the jury, remembering that they're lay individuals, that perhaps this word has a specific legal definition. Well, it doesn't. So their common or collective understanding is sufficient in understanding that instruction. Likewise, with the element they asked about in the first question, when read in context of the whole instruction, it's certainly clear enough. It doesn't have any terms of art that require additional instruction that the court should have provided. So as such, we think that the court did not err in providing the answers. Even if they did, it doesn't rise to plain error. And lastly, the defendant is barred because he invited any potential error. Unless the court has any additional questions, the people respectfully request that this court defer the defendant's convictions. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. McMaster.
Again, I would ask the court to draw the distinction between invited error and plain error. I acknowledge that that second issue has to be decided as a matter of plain error, not invited error. And it's critical because I think you do get to the merits and the responsibility of the trial court to respond affirmatively and concretely in an unambiguous manner as the case law requires. Leonardo does not stand alone. I took a quick glance in my brief. There are at least a half a dozen cases that say essentially the same thing in a variety of contexts. So I would ask you to reverse the conviction of Vicente Mendez accordingly.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Thank you again, Mr. McMaster. We appreciate both of your excellent arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.